On this episode, I'm in conversation with Laura Allison, Associate Director of Quality Improvement at NHS Education for Scotland. Let you know how you can get more involved in the Q community and highlight the Liberating Structures resources. Welcome to the QI Guy in Conversation With podcast. I'm your host and personal improvement advisor, Jonathan O'Reilly. Thank you for joining me as we have a conversation with people from the world of quality improvement working in public services in the four nations of the UK. I hope you're intrigued, enlightened, inspired by the conversations we have each month, and you can let me know what you think about the podcast at the Twitter handle at the QI underscore guy. Thank you to everybody who listened to our first episode with Dr. Leslie Ann Smith and left us feedback on Twitter. It was very much appreciated. If you haven't heard that episode yet, you can go back and listen to it in the archives wherever you subscribe to your podcasts. So how can you get more involved in the Q community? And for those of you that are initiated, what exactly is the Q community? Q is an initiative connecting people who have improvement expertise across the United Kingdom and Ireland. It's delivered by the Health Foundation, and it is expanding rapidly, and we're seeing feels like every other week, every other month, they're opening up that membership for people who have not only expertise, knowledge, some kind of professional qualification in quality improvement, but now people who are interested in learning more about quality improvement and perhaps starting on their journey. And what are the type of things that you can get involved in by joining Q? Well, in pre-pandemic times, and perhaps in future times, they have Q visits, site visits, where they go and visit different industries or different areas of health and look at them through quality. There is the Q exchange, where you're able to come together and share ideas and access funding for those ideas. There's different webinars and learning opportunities that are available, as well as journals and access to different learning resources. And they have a fantastic set of special interest groups where members of Q are able to self-organise themselves based on the different things that they perhaps like or are interested in. And it allows them to connect with like-minded people on those issues across the country. One of the issues or one of the resources that I have managed to get a little bit more knowledge and a little bit more experience on through Q is Liberating Structures. And again, what is Liberating Structures for those of you that are uninitiated? They're a set of resources, tools and techniques that are all about enabling participation and engagement in your meeting or your session. It's cute little tools that you can use to kind of open up that room and perhaps get the more introverted members of your team or at your conference to give you some feedback and participate. There's a book available through Amazon in Liberating Structures. There's also a fantastic app that you can get on Liberating Structures if you search for it in the Apple or Google App Store. And there's also a couple of different ways in which you can practically try this out in a safe space. So as I mentioned earlier, there's the Q Community's Special Interest Group, and they have monthly webinars. I believe the next one is going to be on the 6th of May. So hopefully you're listening to this and the day it drops in the 4th or the 5th. Check the Q Community Special Interest Group. If you're in the Scotland, I could speak with some certainty to say that there's a Scottish Liberating Structures group, which you again you can find on Twitter, and they're beginning to have meetups through Microsoft Teams and Zoom and trying these things out. Great tools for using within your own team and with other teams, and they really open up that participation. And now we come to the main event and the reason I'm sure you've downloaded this episode, which is the conversation I had with Laura Allison. Laura is the Associate Director of Quality Improvement at NHS Education for Scotland, and that is really concerned with building the capacity and capability for quality improvement across the United Kingdom. If you've been involved in the Scottish Quality and Safety Fellowship Programme or the Scottish Improvement Leaders Programme and the various spin-offs of that, then you will have felt the influence of Laura indirectly. I was fortunate enough to be in the first cohort of the Skill Programme, which Laura led. I've also been fortunate enough to be taught beside Laura as a peer when we did a coaching qualification. And I've also had the honour of being coached by Laura. She's someone who has, as you'll pick up from the conversation, a wealth of knowledge and experience, and as somebody who has very much that positive influence and that lasting influence when you come across her. So without further ado, here's my conversation with Laura. So okay. Welcome back, guys, and I'm joined by Laura Allison, the Associate Director of Quality Improvement at NHS Education for Scotland. Hi, Laura. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
You're one of the first names I thought of when I decided to embark on this podcast, because it's all about sharing and learning and kind of all teach, all learn mentality on this podcast, and you were up there on the top of my list.
Well, that's very kind of you. I don't know if that should be the case or not, but we'll
perhaps our listeners be the judge of that at the end of this conversation. So indeed. I just want to start at the beginning. You're obviously working for NHS at the minute as Associate Director of Quality Improvement, but can I just take you back to the start, and how did you enter into the world of NHS and public services and government?
Okay, well, probably not what you're expecting to hear, but probably because I failed my A-levels at school and didn't go to university to do geography, which is what I'd actually planned to do. So I ended up having to have a bit of a rethink, and I had a bit of time to kill. And I actually ended up doing some voluntary work at our local hospital. And it was whilst I was manning a tea trolley, a bit like dinner ladies, I think. And I was the volunteer on an oncology ward. And it was during that time that I just suddenly thought, you know what, actually, I think I'd like to go and do nursing. And that is how I came to join the NHS. So I didn't start nurse training until I was about 20.
Wow. That's interesting. So we have I wouldn't call it a failure. So we say it's learning from your O-levels and perhaps not going the plotted course to thank for having you in the NHS, Laura. So that's interesting. So you started in nursing. Did you kind of specialise in anything in particular? Or how did your nursing career go? And in particular, where did you first encounter QI or change within your nursing role?
So when I finished training, I was working as a nurse on an orthopaedic ward, and then I transitioned into doing high dependency and a little bit of recovery in theatres, and then I ended up having children and decided that it would be a good move to go into the community. So I ended up working as a community nurse, which was actually my last clinical role, which was back in 2006. And it was when I was in that post that I had thought, well, I fancy maybe trying something different. And a job came up working for the Primary Care Collaborative in Scotland. So this was 2007. And so I left my community nursing role to do a year's secondment working as a project manager with three practices to help them improve access for appointments. I never went back. I then moved into a hospital role doing improvement. And so I kind of, none of it was planned. I just sort of went to the next thing and the next thing. So in terms of coming across QI, I suppose officially it would have been when I'd moved into that primary care collaborative job. But Unofficially, I think we're all doing QI all the time from the minute we
Yeah,
start walking,
that's a,
really.
I suppose that's an interesting way to think about it. But yeah, you're absolutely right. We're all PDSing our way through life, perhaps a wee bit more frantically at the minute. So you said you took up a kind of improvement role working in, and that was NHST side at the time.
It
So what
was,
types of
yes,
things were you
indeed.
supporting in that role? Was it still in primary care, or were you working in kind of the wider system?
Well, when I moved out of the primary care job, because that was just for a year, and I moved into Ninewells Hospital, and this was at the start of the 18-week referral to treatment time. So that was my focus probably for around 3 years, and a lot of that was focused on developing clinical pathways. So I almost at the moment feel like I've come full circle, given the work that we're now involved with the access program and waiting times. So yes, it seems quite
That
strange
was
actually.
you took the words out of my mouth, Laura, because that's what was going through my head as you were describing that work in Tayside, which is you're working on the national Access QI program in collaboration with Healthcare Improvement Scotland just now. So yeah, I did that. Is that experience stood you in good stead for what you're doing just now, or are you much wiser?
I would never say I was much wiser about anything, if I'm going to be perfectly honest. But I think it probably has stood me in good stead, because it's one of the aspects of the program is around demand, capacity, activity, queue, and that was a real focus back in 2008, 2009. And I remember working with external consultants that came in, and they were producing realms of data and being met with frosty glances and glares from surgeons. And actually now we're able to, it's good we can do that ourselves. I think it's something that's been missing from what we've been doing to a certain extent. So it's really good to be making this sort of aspect of improvement a real core part of our programs.
Yeah, excellent. So you moved then from NHS say, was it Scottish Government you went to next?
It was
And
that was a deep another unplanned move.
there's a theme in these conversations about taking opportunities. I think it must be something about the world of improvement that attracts people that just a moth to a flame. So what is it you went to do working in Scottish Government?
So when I went into Scottish Government, it was just at the start of 2013, and it was at this point in time when there was a real drive to spread the use of quality improvement around the whole of public sector, so not just health. All the different sectors that you could possibly do. So within government, they had set up what they called the leading improvement team to do precisely that, start working across education, justice, all sorts of areas. And I think there was about six or seven of us in the team, and I was one of those people. That there was three of us that were seconded in from health, and everyone else was a civil servant. So that was a really interesting time, because it was just a whole new world.
That's interesting. You're obviously, I mean, myself, my background is in health and care, and a lot of people who will listen to this conversation, that might also be their background. Could you speak a wee bit to the opportunities and the challenges that existed when you were applying QI in other areas of public service?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the biggest challenges was actually the voice of the leaders and the leadership. And one of the things that we were really pinned to when we were spreading this was the public sector improvement framework, three steps. First one's about vision, which is responsibility of the leaders. Second one's about the managers being able to create the conditions to help that happen. And then the last part is around actually the people who deliver those services doing the improvement. And I think for health, we had some really clear leaders who understood the benefits of using QI because they'd experienced that through the patient safety program. And I think that that particular aspect just wasn't in the system at that point in time. There was pockets of it. So it was that made it more challenging in terms of engaging with people. And because it was new, we didn't have evidence in their sector. So, building up that knowledge and building the will was really I think the at that point in time the biggest sort of challenge and where we put all of our energy.
And I mean, that's a key message, I suppose, that relates to any improvement activity, that building the will, understanding and applying the evidence, not to assume that you know all of that. So you joined Scottish Government in 2013, but I first met you in 2014 as the professional lead for the Scottish Improvement Leaders Programme. How did you come by that opportunity? Because you hadn't quite moved to working with NHS Education for Scotland yet.
No, again, there's the theme. I was in the this time I was in the wrong place at the wrong time and did my usual of saying, yes, of course I'll do that for you. So we had historically had an external partner to deliver the kind of lead level improvement training within Scotland. And we got to the stage, I think, where it was felt that we were at a tipping point and we could do it ourselves. And the money was secured to test this out, which was great. Once the money had been secured, it was a case of, well, who's going to do this then? And that's where I came in. And it literally was a kind of a, could you just go and see if you could set up this program? And that probably was the one of the most life-changing things of my career. And I think about that program now and how much we do and how much we deliver. But that first cohort, I remember sitting in the Golden Jubilee Conference Centre thinking, I really hope the first presenter turns up. I haven't got a clue what they're going to say, but I'm sure it'll be good and we can just take it from there. So it was sort of flying by the seat of my pants for sure.
It didn't seem that way. I had obviously the pleasure of being on that first cohort, where I think we were often referred to as the guinea pigs, but you certainly gave an air of being in control and being on top of everything.
Yeah, well, I better not say anything else because any credibility I might have could disappear rapidly.
So the work you were doing with Scottish Government there and now working with NHS, you're talking about kind of building capacity and capability for QI and educating people and the tools and the relational side of QI. What is it that kind of draws you to that, what does that provide for you? Why do you enjoy it?
Yeah, and I mean it's an interesting one because I did hit this sort of point where I had to make a decision, and it was either you carry on working with teams and supporting them, and coaching them, or you take on focusing on building capacity and developing those programs of work. And I really wasn't 100% sure that I was doing the right thing, and I had to sit there and go, what is it that floats my boat? What is it that makes me feel like I have had a good day at the end of the day? And I kind of thought, if I just go into doing building capacity, am I going to be limiting what I can do in the future? And anyway, I sat down and I assessed it all, and I thought, what I really like is nurturing people and helping them to achieve their potential. It's the thing to see other people be able to go on and really achieve things. It's just so rewarding, and it's I just think that for me was the part that made it. And because you know through that the impact you can have on the system, and albeit it's one or two or three steps away from the front line, it is still making a difference. And that's really important to me.
Excellent. And obviously skills now, in its seventh year, and I think it's in the cohort numbers in the 30s.
It is, yeah.
What's changed over those 7 years in terms of the focus of that QI education? Has it changed? Are you teaching people different things? What how have you changed over that 7 years in terms of your approach?
I was left in charge of managing the first three cohorts before we then got I'd sort of got promoted, so we got another program lead in. And I think where we started was that there was a lot, if I said it this way, we were 80% technical, 20% relational. And that balance has completely swung. And for me, I think, in short, quality improvement tools are really relatively simple. It's a toolkit that's there, but unless you have got the ability to engage, empower, inspire, and manage relationships and build those, then you just won't get anywhere. And it's all, to me, it is all about making sure that you are focusing on the system goals and just not focusing on your own goals. And I think that's the key part.
So I think that's absolutely correct, because I know observing it from the outside in, and later cohorts, I did see a difference in that focus, moving from more we focus in the first cohort very much in the technical tools and how to do a good QI project, as it were, and then we would see people talking about different references and moving more into that relational side of things. I wonder, what's your view on capacity and capability building in the second year, if you like, of a global pandemic, when much of, if not all of your efforts for NHS Education in Scotland are delivered online? Do you think you're still able to maintain that balance, and how do you and how might others do that in a kind of a virtual online environment where you can't get face to face and perhaps have that personal connection quite the
Yeah,
same?
so I think there's two parts to that, because there's the what the system needs now in terms of educational interventions, but also how you do that training virtually. So we've done virtual training for a while. We were doing that before the pandemic, but it was much sort of lighter touch. And there was less kind of accountability, less sort of pressure on evidencing and demonstrating your learning. So with our longer programs, we want people to be able to demonstrate that they can apply the tools, whether they're successful or not in their improvement goals. So I think that it can actually be more effective doing online training, but in order to do that effectively, we're having to think really hard about the design of the program and the size of the cohorts and the frequency of the interactions in between when we're meeting up. I think that there's been a tendency in the past where we have made it quite easy for people to learn by bringing them together. I think when you're doing it online, the onus is much more on the individual for being able to take forward the work that they're doing in between times of sessions and reflecting on that. And so I think it's completely possible virtually, as I said, and I think it's more effective. I think the other thing is actually because of the pandemic, what we've had is a historic model of building a lot of improvement leaders in the system who we then ensure we're equipping to go and teach within their own environments. And because of the rapid system changes that have gone on, what we actually are looking at trying to do is increase the pace and reach of people being able to access the tools and the knowledge to do it. So we still need to build in-depth improvement leaders, but we need to reach more people to support them to be able to take forward these rapid system changes.
And is that your thinking behind you've made the kind of foundation course materials that NESA developed available on the website for others to use? Is that your kind of thinking behind that you can take that and do that within your organisation and your relatively assured about the standard of learning and materials that they cover?
Yes, absolutely. They are part of the core, but actually the new access program, which we're about to start running from June, does that, but in a more robust way, because what it's doing is we're ensuring we're linking people in the system who already have training to support them. So again, it kind of makes sure that there's infrastructure. And the right wraparound support in people's own organizations to be able to take that forward.
Excellent. So you mentioned earlier when you were talking about the impact that you can have with that kind of national lead level program, but how do you seek assurance? How are you evaluating that those capacity and capability activities, the education programs that you have, are actually improving kind of process and outcomes for folk?
Yeah, this is a really challenging one because we do use an evaluation framework called Kirkpatrick. Some of you might have come across it. So you're always looking at what's the environment like for a learner? Is it conducive for them to be able to take on board what we're saying? And then if that environment is conducive, are we actually seeing them act on that knowledge? And if they are acting on that knowledge, we're able to start to see that within their improvement projects, behaviors are starting to change, testing is happening, you can start to see those small improvements in the system. I think what's the most challenging is when you can look at large scale change, and I think it's literally impossible to be able to attribute that just to the fact that someone's been on a quality improvement course because the system's so complex, there's so many different factors that would impact on something that it would be unwise to say that it's purely down to this. Another way that you can completely flip that on the head is to actually turn around and say, well, how would this be if we were not delivering any quality improvement training at all? There's different ways that you can look at that.
Yeah, it's interesting. I see in social media and on Twitter people having that discussion about the impact. And often that's what I think the experiment would be. You switch off all your capacity and capability activity and see what happens. But people get, I think, a lot of value from being on this and an increased level of knowledge from exposure to the tools and techniques and the different theories and approaches. And it is, I think you're absolutely right. The system is complex, and I don't think you would ever dream of drawing a direct line from, hey, I went on this course, that's why my service has improved and is now better.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
So for folk that are developing perhaps their own capacity and capability activities, Laura, what do you think is the next big opportunity or big challenge that they need to consider?
So I think that technology is a big challenge. I think that harnessing technology to be able to do things remotely is a huge part. I think that there is also a much greater emphasis on coaching now. And I think that if people are sort of looking at, right, what's the next big thing, or what should we be looking out for? I think it's actually about just making sure you are flexible and open to new methodology as it comes, and looking really closely as well as specifically at what complements quality improvement. And service design is a fantastic example of that. I think that sometimes what I can come across is people can become wedded to just one method, and I don't think that's the right thing. I think that there are multiple methods that are suitable for multiple contexts, and you know, quality improvement is not always the right thing for, you know, certain areas of work. So I think it's about that openness, flexibility, and looking at what complements the approaches you take so that you can achieve the system improvements that you're looking for.
Yeah, I think it's, you know, that's key. It's the right kind of solution or approach for the right problem. And it's really key, you mentioned that coaching approach, that people take that coaching approach to actually understand what it is people want to do, why they want to do it, and then bringing the right tool, whether that be the model of improvement or the double diamond or whatever it would be. So yeah, coaching, perhaps the next big thing.
Well, it's interesting because I got asked a question this week from somebody who had done the improvement leader course, and they said, what do we do next? Do we do the fellowship next? And I said, well, no, you don't do the fellowship next. That's not really how it works. I said, you know, you probably want to be thinking about, well, if you haven't got a master's, do you want to do a master's? And don't go and do a master's in quality improvement. Do it in something that broadens your skill set more. But what I have seen and what we have done within our team is the next natural progression has been to move on to getting accredited as a coach, because the combination of coaching and QI is incredibly powerful.
Yeah, and we did the kind of coaching teams for improvement qualification together, and I certainly know that that's had a real impact in my mindset and how I approach conversations with individuals and teams around improvement before we even get to the tools bit.
Yeah, absolutely.
So as we wind up here, Laura, I'd be keen to know what your top tip or top tips for anyone that's interested in quality improvement and getting started in quality improvement.
So top tips would be keep learning. Just don't ever stop learning about anything. Keep being curious. And I think that the keep learning and don't be complacent is crucial. And I think that the more you hear about QI or read about it, you will always pick up something slightly different. And so that's why you just want to keep yourself in that growth mindset, really. And I think the other thing is look out. I just have this kind of like little bugbear where when we have people starting on programs and looking at projects, I could probably over the last 7 years say that I've seen the same kind of project in the same kind of area, and everybody feels that they're the only one and they're starting from scratch and reinventing the wheel. And actually, there is so much to learn from what people have already done, that I just think the more people can look at and seek that kind of information, the better.
Fabulous. Fabulous tips there. I think they apply to everyone, whether you're a beginner or a so-called expert. So, Laura, thank you for taking the time to have a conversation with me today. Thank you very much. Thank you to Laura Allison for such an engaging and informative conversation, all things QI and QI capacity and capability building. Well, it reinforces the need for capacity capability building and the benefits of that as we see the health service undergoing such rapid change as it has done this past year. Thank you for listening to this episode of the QI Guy in conversation with. I hope you enjoyed it. Tell us what you think about the podcast, leave a PDSA or should I say a review, wherever you find us. And please subscribe to the podcast wherever you get yours. And until next month, take care.
Well, thank you very much for having me. That's gone very quickly. I was ready to tell you about the book to read, my favourite joke, all the rest of it. None of it. None of it.